Before we jump into today's episode, I wanted to let you know about a powerful free resource for Lent. It's a devotional excerpt from Lent and Easter for Everyone by N.T. Wright, featuring daily scripture reflections for a week to guide you from the wilderness to the wonder of Easter. Whether you observe Lent every year or you're just exploring it for the first time, this short devotional will help you slow down and grow in wisdom this season. Download your free copy today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now on to the show.
Hi, it's Gavin.
I'm Phil.
I don't know about you, but it can sometimes feel like we're living in a bad news world. Wars, scandals, crisis after crisis.
But if you're ready to change the soundtrack and hear what God is really doing, we have a brand new podcast just for you.
We're traveling the UK, seeing people come to faith, churches grow, and new life break out.
With real stories, fresh research, and inspiring leaders, we are ready to give you a front row seat to God on the move.
Good News People is a new podcast from Premier and the Evangelical Alliance.
So listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are Good News People in a bad news world.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we're going to be talking about what has become known as the social media addiction trial, which is going to be, it's quite a name. This was happening in the United States, where else? And I'll just briefly read the headline in the first few sentences of a BBC news story about this, and you can explain why you think this should be of interest to us. TikTok settles just before social media addiction trial to begin. TikTok has reached a settlement to avoid it being involved in a landmark social media addiction trial a matter of hours before jury selection was due to begin. The plaintiff, a 20-year-old woman, identified by the initials KJM, alleges the design of the platform's algorithms left her addicted to social media and negatively affected her mental health. The defendants now include Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, and Google, the parent company of YouTube.
Yeah, so I think this is a really significant legal case going on in California. And it's because there have been concerns about social media and the negative consequences of social media, as we know, going on for, in fact, decades. And so far, the companies that produce the social media apps have managed to avoid accountability for the harms coming from their apps. And meanwhile, there has been growing concern, and it's something we've dealt with on the podcast previously, haven't we, particularly about the impact of social media like TikTok and so on young people.
Yes. We talked in particular, I think, about a very influential book that came out a year or two ago called The Anxious Generation by the American writer Jonathan Haidt, in which he kind of makes the case that the explosion in young people's mental ill health, particularly depression and anxiety, over the last 15 years can be directly connected to the corresponding kind of explosion in popularity of smartphones, in particular social media. And that's been very influential. I think a lot of people have been quite compelled by that argument. And I think the conversation has shifted very decisively, at least in the West, to not, you know, does social media cause harm to young people? But it does cause harm to people, so what should we do about it?
And there does seem to be something uniquely addictive about TikTok. I mean, all these social media apps have an addictive component, and there are lots of this. And of course, this is all by design, that very clever engineers testing different mechanisms in order to maximize what they call user engagement, the number of hours they spend on the platform. And just from personal observation, you know, anecdotally, having talked to some young teenagers, it is astonishing, particularly how TikTok seems to create a kind of addictive cycle. I can remember talking to one young woman of 15 who was frequently went to bed at, you know, 9 or 10, and was then frequently on her phone into 4 a.m., 5 a.m. And when you asked what she was doing, she was just watching this continuous spool of short form videos going on and on and on and on and on. And it was clear that she felt this was not very good, because she was desperately tired and, you know, and difficult to get up in the morning. And yet she herself felt that it was out of control. She couldn't control it, really, that she was just, and she wasn't watching porn. I think she was watching sort of cat videos and people doing silly, trivial, you know, stunts.
Yeah. There's something, I mean, I think you're right. A lot of these features, so things like, it's often called an infinite scroll. So that's the idea that you can never reach the end of the feed. It's just in the background, the app is just constantly loading up new content, videos or whatever to watch. And also the fact that these are very kind of bite-sized, short form. These are not, you know, even 5 or 6 minute videos. These are 20 seconds, 30 seconds, 90 seconds at an absolute tops. And they've been designed to be kind of cut straight to the kind of reward centers in the brain. You say there's no fanning about with introductions and titles. You just get right into it, and it does become quite addictive. I spoke with a Christian youth worker for an article I was writing last year about TikTok, and she said that she had once kind of sat down with the young people she worked with at the youth group, most of them Christians, and said, you know, I asked them, you know, what's the average amount of hours per day you'll spend on the app? And it was something like 4 or 5 was the average for these teenagers. So you think they're all this, given they can't do this when they're at school on the whole, which is takes up what, 6-7 hours of the day. So these children are spending, as you say, incredibly inordinary for teenagers today to spend upwards of 2, 3, 4 hours in every single evening on their phones. And it's not just TikTok. I mean, a lot of those features have been copied over into YouTube, you know, YouTube Shorts or Instagram Reels. Basically take the same basic idea of a never-ending series of bite-sized videos that you just swipe, 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 swipe. But they do say that TikTok's algorithm is especially good at learning what you like to watch and just feeding you more and more and more and more and more.
And it all goes back to the advertising model, doesn't it? Because why are all these apps addictive by design? And the answer is because they're all funded by adverts, and therefore there is a direct relationship between the amount of time you spend and the exposure to adverts. And so all this is very carefully monitored and monetized. And so there is a very strong incentive for all these companies to develop highly addictive products and to keep you, right, to use every possible device to keep you there. And there's something called dark patterns, which is where the engineers have worked out, you know, because the power of this technology is that engineers can do A versus B comparisons continuously, yes, which is what they do, you know. So they take one group of TikTok videos and they give it a particular format, maybe the color it comes or the precise position on the screen, the how much it flashes, you know. Then they do another one comparison. They then look at the data and they say, yeah, well, interestingly, we've got, you know, 0.04 increased seconds of average engagement, so we'll go to this one, and now we'll do another A versus B comparison, and so on and so on and so on. So this constant process of optimization to grab you and hold you on the platforms.
Yes. And I think going back to the trial at the beginning, what is interesting is that this case that's kicking off in Los Angeles is actually just the first of what will be about over 20, they think, kind of bellwether trials, which are being kind of coordinated and covering 1,600 plaintiffs involving more than 350 families in 250 school districts. So the theory is that rather than just one person saying, I was harmed, is that you create a whole massive series of people, schools, parents, individuals saying, we were addicted, we suffered because of these apps, and hoping to establish a kind of precedent and get damages from these gigantic tech companies that will to kind of recompense for the harm caused. Though, of course, the tech companies strongly deny that they their platforms are responsible for any harm.
Yes, and the principal defence of the tech companies goes back to something called Section 230 of the, I think, is it the Communications Decency
Act.
Act. Yes. So do you want to explain this to us? Passed by Congress in 1996.
So this is right at the beginning of the kind of internet era in the mid-90s. You know, the World Wide Web has been set up and people are starting to experiment with the internet. And they quite quickly realize that the growth of this new communications medium could be very strongly curtailed if the handful of internet service providers, the companies that literally plugged you into, and in those days there was no Wi-Fi, it was all being physically plugged into cables to connect to the internet, if they could be held liable for the things that people did. You know, so for the messages they posted on message boards, the emails they sent. And ordinarily, previously, law has held, you know, if you're a book publisher and you publish a book, it's not the author who is held responsible if they say something bad or do something bad, it's the publisher. And the internet service providers were very keen to not be treated as publishers. And so Section 230 was a piece of law in the United States which basically created immunity from legal liability for people of providing a, quote, interactive computer service. So if you're AOL, let's say, and you plug in Joe Bloggs to the internet, Joe Bloggs goes onto an early message board and spews some vile, hatred, libelous, defamatory rant, or even worse, you know, uses your services to hack into a computer and cause harm. The person who's responsible is Joe Bloggs, not AOL, who kind of facilitated that. And lots of people see Section 230 as the kind of cornerstone of what enabled the internet to kind of become such a fundamental part of modern life, because without any fear of liability, you know, a thousand flowers bloomed and people were connected left, right and center. The open internet kind of exploded and eventually gave birth to what we now know as, you know, the social web and social media, where, you know, it's a fire hose of free speech within reason. And so a lot of people say Section 230 is such a really critical part of the infrastructure, regulatory infrastructure, for allowing the internet to become such a pivotal part of our life.
Yeah. And I've just read that Section 230 has been called the 26 words that made the internet. but it's very interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, we're talking 1990s. Mm. And as you say, those early days of the World Wide Web and so on. And at that point, advertising was not a central feature. I mean, no. The whole essence of the World Wide Web came out of a sort of 1960s, 1970s hippie style sense that open source was best, information wanted to be free, you know, make it all available. We're small brew. We're nothing to do with big mega corporations making lots of money. We are homebrew hobbyists. And we just want to make it all free. And it's going to be great. Peace, truth, love, man. And, you know,
you're absolutely right. But the other aspect as well is that it came out of the academic world. So remember, the World Wide Web itself was invented by Tim Berners-Lee while he was working at CERN, which is a massive international scientific collaboration in particle physics between a number of different governments and international agencies. And they were, their idea was, you know, we don't, you know, we're not thinking about money here. We're about exchanging, we're nerds, you know, and nerds want to set up message boards and do nerdy things and exchange information and create repositories of odd databases. And the internet is brilliant for all of that. We're not thinking about creating this as a kind of functioning capitalist economic system. It's about, you know, strange nerds in ill-fitting glasses and sweaters in offices underground in Switzerland being able to send data to each other across international borders.
Now, don't you be rude about the ill-fitting jumpers of the nerds. So having said that, in the interests of accuracy, one has to say there was also significant military funding behind the internet. It wasn't all...
No. Yeah, it was the unholy trifecta of the particle physics nerds, the 60 hippies and the US Department of Defense.
Quite right.
And it's hundreds of billions defense budget.
Correct. But so the interesting thing is, so we've got to the late 1990s and Google has now invented an amazingly effective search engine. And interestingly, the founders, Brin and Page were both against using advertising pop-ups in a search engine. Back in 1998, were very keen to keep it free and as a public service and all the rest. But the big question was how to monetize. You know, as we're spending more and more money providing search to millions of people, how are we going to monetize it? And in 2000, Google began selling adverts associated with search keywords. So as soon as you put in a search, then the idea came, you know, and then gradually that took off, and advertisers then fought to get their adverts onto Google AdWords and so on.
Yeah, and Google's kind of brilliant breakthrough was this idea that they create a kind of behind-the-scenes system where companies kind of bid against each other to have their advert associated with that keyword. So when someone searches bed, you think they might want to buy a bed. And so bed companies would bid against each other to have their advert top of the rankings. And then Google kind of smuggles them in and they don't differentiate them that carefully. So can you really tell what is a Google search result and what is an advert? And that gets blurred. And this basically becomes a money printing machine for Google. Basically, the entire modern company of Google, even to this day, is still primarily built on search revenue selling advertising against searches. That's what pays for, you know, all their devices and their moonshots and their self-driving cars and all that stuff is fundamentally driven out of this enormous success in selling adverts online.
And it is interesting, isn't it? Because it didn't have to be that way. I mean, we don't buy our phone communication based on adverts. We pay a monthly subscription for lots of things. You know, so if they had said, well, if you want Google, you know, you pay £10, $10 a month.
Yeah.
How valuable is it to you to be able to search the internet? And I suspect that a large number of people would have signed up. It wouldn't have been anything like the amount of money that they made, but it would nonetheless have made a steady income. But for good or ill, they went the advertising route. And I think the rest is history, because I understand it was really the success of Google that really then led the social media companies, when Mark Zuckerberg had the same problem. I've got this fantastic thing called Facebook, you know, but I can't make any money out of it.
And Google, I think you're right, had kind of showed the way. But also, I think it's critical not to underestimate the, because we've kind of moved our way from the moment. But at this point, in the 90s and early 2000s, it was kind of inconceivable to pay for subscription services on the internet. You know, that's the same thing happened with news. You know, all these news organizations who had for hundreds of years never considered the idea that they would give away their newspaper for free. Yes, it also had advertising as a secondary income stream, but of course, it's a product, you buy it. Suddenly said, well, to set up on the internet and we'll publish the same stories that someone buys in print at the newsagents, we'll put it on for free on the internet. And in the 90s, that was a tiny sideline and no one cared. And then suddenly in the 2000s, everyone stopped buying the newspaper and the newsagent and reading it online for free. And the rest, as they say, is history. And I think it wasn't just that it worked for Google, but also it seemed inconceivable in 2006 when Facebook starts taking off for them to put up a paywall and say, if you want to be part of this, people would have laughed at them. What am I paying for? We had got so embedded in this culture that the internet is this kind of hippy dippy post-capitalist playground where everything is free and we're just surfing and the net dude. It's only now, I think, that people are starting to tumble into actually there are consequences for pursuing a free advertising funded model. And actually in my own sector of news, you know, basically one by one, the newspapers and news outlets have realized that was a terrible, terrible, catastrophic error of judgment and have desperately spent the last 15 years trying to re-erect paywalls around their content and hitting up against the fact that people have lost the habit. They've been trained to expect to get news for free and they know there's elsewhere on the internet they can get their news for free. So why would I pay a subscription?
That's really interesting perspective, and I can, you know, for a journalist, this is very close to home, isn't it?
Very much so.
But it's also true to say, isn't it, that to some extent that's been successful. That the big players have been able to get a significant income stream,
yes,
by using paywalls, and with a heavy heart, many of us have been prepared to pay a monthly subscription.
Yes, it's worked for the, as you said, the big players, the New York Times, the Times here in the UK, and interestingly, even the Guardian has, which refuses to put a paywall up out of kind of principle. Who knows why? But they basically have worked very hard to build up a cadre of voluntary people making voluntary payments out of the goodwill of their hearts, and through lots of other cuts and things like that, have actually managed to get back into profit as well. What is the challenge is the once you take away those handful, dozen or so kind of national and international English language news brands, who can survive in this internet? You know, and it all comes back to Google, right? I got my first job at a local newspaper. There used to be thousands of those across the UK, tens of thousands probably in the United States.
You were our man in Tunbridge Wells, weren't you?
I was, yes. I was working in Tunbridge Wells, which for those who don't know is an exceptionally kind of stereotypically leafy commuter town south of London, famous for basically nothing apart from, you know, well-to-do
amazingly good local newspaper.
Hot under the collar about unimportant things. But those local newspapers actually thrived on advertising from local businesses. So if you were a Tunbridge Wells-based carpet seller and you wanted to sell your wares, where would you go to find people in Tunbridge Wells? You would go to the Kent and Sussex Courier, the newspaper I worked at, and you would put adverts there. And they also sold the paper for a cover price, but actually the bulk of the revenue came from adverts. Everyone in Tunbridge Wells, if you want to sell carpets or phones or beds or pets, what do? You go and buy advertising on Facebook and on Google, and Google can not just find you someone in Tunbridge Wells, they can find you a single pet-loving 30-something mum who goes to the gin and drinks too much wine, has been recently emailing about wanting to go on holiday, and they'll sell you an ad for that person. A level of specificity that the newspapers can't compete. And that fundamental loss of advertising revenue is why the local media in this country and in much of the Western world has fallen off a cliff.
And what's happened to your local newspaper?
It still exists, but it has been hollowed out. I mean, it was already, I arrived in 2013 when this was already underway, and it has been hollowed out even further. So because it can't afford to put a paywall up online, or at least it believes it can't, its website has been forced to chase clicks from anywhere. Mm. So you think the raison d'etre of a newspaper in Tunbridge Wells is to write about Tunbridge Wells, but they now put on their website, last time I checked, anything that they think is going viral on the internet that has no connection to their patch, but someone idly scrolling might want to click on it, which generates 0.0001p in advertising revenue from the online ad they put around their free site. And, you know, but it's fundamentally a losing business, and it will cease to exist in the coming years and decades.
If you've ever wrestled with questions like who goes to hell or should Christians believe in evolution, you're not alone. That's why this month, when you support Premier Insight, we'll send you a digital booklet of N.T. Wright's most thought-provoking Q&A columns as our thank you for your gift. Your support keeps content like this podcast going and helps more people grow in wisdom through biblical truth. Gift today and get your copy at premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death. That's premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death.
Hi, it's Gavin.
And Phil.
I don't know about you, but it can sometimes feel like we're living in a bad news world. Wars, scandals, crisis after crisis.
But if you're ready to change the soundtrack and hear what God is really doing, we have a brand new podcast just for you.
We're traveling the UK, seeing people come to faith, churches grow, and new life break out.
With real stories, fresh research, and inspiring leaders, we are ready to give you a front row seat to God on the move.
Good News People is a new podcast from Premier and the Evangelical Alliance.
So listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are Good News People in a bad news world.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
So to come back, there's unintended consequences here, aren't there? I mean, yeah. I'm sure Google never foresaw what the longer-term implications of going the advertising route was going to be. But here we end up with these trials with TikTok and Meta and Google. and these highly addictive, highly effective products. And the only, it seems, there's a great deal of hand-wringing going on, great deal of hand-wringing amongst parents, amongst governments, amongst, you know, the public as a whole. But these companies appear to be virtually immune. And the reason I find this a fascinating topic is it appears, at least in the States, that really the only powerful, the way of getting back at these companies, of trying to achieve accountability and justice for those who've been harmed, is to use common law, the so-called tort law, where people are held account financially, can be sued for the consequences of their actions.
Yes, and so this explains why we're talking about Section 230, because that still remains in force. And so if you say, TikTok, I was watching these addictive videos from this hateful account and it made me sad or caused this harm, they can say, well, we're not responsible for how people use our platform. You can't hold us liable for what one TikTok influencer did. But what is interesting and potentially precedent setting in these cases that are beginning in LA is that they aren't suing over what third parties on TikTok or Google or Instagram or Facebook are posting, but about the design choices, the architecture of the app itself, which is nothing to do with Section 230. So they're saying it's not just that TikTok is full of bad people spewing bad stuff that makes me feel bad, but it's that the way the TikTok algorithm, the way its notifications, the design of the app, everything about it sucks me in and makes it impossible for me to break free of the bad stuff that people are putting on TikTok. And that stuff is not shielded by 230. And that stuff is absolutely fair game for these lawsuits.
And it is interesting that it seems that governments by and large have been ineffective in trying to control these massive social media companies. You know, the European legal, you know, the EU has been involved in some legal action and so on, and attempts to try and control monopoly and so on. But by and large, these companies seem to be able to operate it with such a degree of impunity. And of course, they have massive lobbying budgets, so that if ever it appears there's a risk that a government somewhere in the world might be going to cause us to damage our bottom line, we can throw millions of pounds at highly professional lobbyists to try to suborn the legislative process. So I think it is interesting that it is the lawyers in the end who are the personal lawyers who seem to be like almost the final court of appeal, at least in Western democratic societies. Obviously, I suspect it's rather different in totalitarian regimes, including communist China.
Yes, it's not difficult for Xi Jinping to exercise direct influence if he wishes to over China's version of TikTok, which is, of course, where TikTok originates. I mean, it's worth pointing out that actually this trial begins at a very interesting moment, because it's not the only methodology that people are using to try and rein in these same tech companies. And everyone's got eyes on Australia, which late last year became the first country in the world to actually introduce a ban. So under 16s are banned from using the suite of the kind of major social media apps. And the companies are liable for stiff fines if they're found to have allowed an under 16 year old to set up an account. Just in the last week or two, the UK government here has said, you know, it's watching with interest and is started a consultation to see if what appetite there might be for a similar under 16 ban on social media in this country. So that's, I suppose, the polar opposite of the kind of individual tort law lawsuit that you're talking about. This is the kind of sweeping legislative power of governments to regulate. Of course, the companies hit back and say, if you try and use this kind of crude, blunt instrument of just a sweeping ban, all that will happen is that young, addicted young people, they don't use that language, of course, will try and skirt around it and end up using dodgy VPNs or even on, you know, strange, eccentric TikTok clones that haven't yet been regulated. And so they argue, you know, it's safer rather than trying to shut the whole thing down. It's safer to let them use TikTok, but, you know, work with us to try and make the platform safer.
I mean, it's interesting. The attraction of the tort law approach is, of course, that it threatens the companies and the things they guard most carefully, which is the bottom line.
Yeah.
I mean, it would only take a few massive legal settlements of hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, with potentially, you know, people lining up. Once you get one successful claim, of course, people start lining up.
Yeah.
And there have been interesting examples. I mean, in the discussion we had before we started recording, we just looked at a number of previous examples, like the tobacco companies, who, you know, for 50 years, there was evidence of harm, and particularly of lung cancer and so on. But in the end, it was legal action and suits which made a difference. And we also, there's famous cases with asbestos and with opioid pain killers, where legal action in the States ultimately resulted in companies often going bankrupt and ceasing production of the harmful entities.
Yeah, and your point about kind of the inability of governments to rein it in is very relevant in those instances, because you know, another example might be, you know, efforts to try and make car manufacturers put in seat belts and make their cars safer, as it became clearer how deadly car crashes were becoming in the mid of the 20th century. Governments were fairly powerless for years. You know, as you say, we knew that tobacco caused lung cancer. The government itself said it, and yet it got nobbled by lobbyists anytime someone tried to actually get something through Congress to make tobacco safer or to limit its spread. And it took, as you say, a combination of a series of lawsuits and kind of changing social mores, I guess, around our tolerance of that for it finally to kick in.
So it's interesting, isn't it? I think coming to a Christian perspective in all this, because I think a sort of immediate response might be, you know, this is all rather grubby, you know, going to law and instructing lawyers and suing companies and so on. And it's something that by and large Christians would feel was inappropriate. And yet in democratic societies as they're currently constituted, it appears to be the last resort of ensuring some kind of justice and some kind of accountability for massively powerful companies who are causing intense and permanent harm to vulnerable individuals.
I think some Christians will be uncomfortable with the idea that this can all be broken down to a financial sum. I mean, remember the story we began with at the beginning is that TikTok has settled. You know, so TikTok was one of the defendants in this big social media addiction lawsuit, but no longer because they've settled. What does the settlement mean? Well, it largely means they've written a very large check to the person suing them to persuade that person to stop suing them. Is that a good, is that a win? Is TikTok going to change its algorithm? Is it going to stop being so harmful for the millions of other people who don't receive the large check? I mean, I think some people might have questions about, is this a bit reductionist? The tort law system, the only remedy is financial, largely.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's very crude. And you're quite right. The real problem with settling out of court is it nearly always goes with a non-disclosure agreement. So part of the deal, we pay you a large sum of money and you are absolutely silenced. You can't say anything. Nobody can say anything. Nobody can say how much money. Nobody can say what the case was based on. And if you do, we'll sue you.
And you don't get any of that discovery that comes out in the court cases in which you can subpoena documents and email chains, which is often the most kind of explosive testimony because it, you know, I'm thinking of unrelated, but, you know, when there was defamation lawsuits against a series of right-wing media outlets who were supporting Donald Trump's false claim to have won the 2020 election. Some of these people who were accused of kind of facilitating the stolen election sued, and they were able to show that actually all these Fox News presenters, when the cameras weren't rolling, were happily texting each other saying, of course, there's no merit to this. Of course, we don't believe Trump won the election. We're just whipping up our base. And that was the most kind of that's the biggest win, really. Not the fact that the person ended up with a check at the end for so many million dollars, but was kind of exposing the dishonesty behind it all.
Absolutely. And it is said that these social media companies have internal memos and research and emails all saying that they knew perfectly well that this was causing terrible harm. And that's all been hushed up. So I think the discovery in court is a very powerful thing. Having said that, you know, I would think TikTok are not sleeping easy in their bed because, you know, if there's one person, this will surely motivate, because the lawyers win on this too. They will have their
the lawyers fees. Always win, Dad. Whatever happens, the lawyers always win.
So hang on a minute. Why not? You know, the lawyers will be saying, anybody else damaged by TikTok? You know, come and see us. We are your TikTok lawyers. So I think once the process, you know, so settling out of court is in itself a kind of admission that our case is not watertight and therefore we're vulnerable. So I think I think it's an interesting, I think this is a very strategic moment. And if you take historical precedence, it would not be completely impossible for this suddenly to start unraveling for these big companies. Because if they find themselves on the hook for billions of dollars, the investors will start saying, you know, this is not a viable business.
What about the idea that Christians aren't supposed to kind of use the law courts to resolve disputes, and that, you know, there is this, of course, a role for the church to be kind of prophetic, and maybe you could make the case that one of our callings to be prophetic is about the harm that social media is causing to young people, but we don't go through the law courts. That's not the kind of Jesus way. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I think it really does apply to disputes between Christians. And I think one of the things I've been very saddened about is there has been a trend where there have been disputes between Christians, including things like employment issues within Christian organisations, that there seems to have been a move towards the parties instructing expensive lawyers and slapping legal injunctions on one another. And I think this is deeply unhelpful, and I think within the Christian community we should strongly argue against this, you know, this tendency, which I think has come from America but is certainly visible in the UK, including I think the use of non-disclosure agreements, because I think non-disclosure agreements are a very powerful tool, but they effectively gag everyone. Even once these cases have finished, nobody can talk about it. We never know. Something terrible happened. You know, people resigned. All kinds of things happened. And when you say, well, come on, we really need to know what happened, they say, it's all covered by the law, legal. Mm-hmm. We're all gagged.
Yeah, I know, I agree. And I think it seems quite clear from that particular passage people point to in I think it's in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul is talking about two Christians within the church who have a dispute, who are going to a secular magistrate to try and resolve it. And he's very upset with them for doing that, shall we say, and strongly orders them to try and resolve it within, you know, before the Lord's people, rather than seeking a kind of non-Christian judge to be the arbiter. And in fact, he himself was happy to use the secular legal system when it suited him, including claiming his right to appeal to Caesar. You see that in Acts several times, using the fact that he happened to be a Roman citizen to protect himself from arbitrary punishment. And, you know, the same Roman Empire that was persecuting Christians, he was very happy to utilize when it worked in God's favor, those same legal principles. So I don't think you can argue that it's kind of out of court. Out of bounds for a, no pun intended, out of bounds for a Christian to seek to act justly and love mercy and, you know, be Jesus' hands and feet in this way through a secular legal system.
Yeah, and I think it fits with, you know, what he says in Romans 13, a very well-known passage, that it is the authorities that God has put in place and it's their responsibility to execute justice. And part of the way by which, you know, Roman emperors executed justice was through the legal system. It was Roman law and Roman law, including tort law, which is a very important influence, I understand, in our current system in both UK and USA, our common law systems. So I think there's no fundamental reason why operating law cannot be used in a godly way. But having said all that, I think we recognise that it can be exceedingly murky, and it very easily, the whole legal system can become corrupted itself. And become obsessed with money and influence and all the rest. But I would also frame this within the overall field of what is often called harm minimization. I mean, our goal is not primarily to try to create a godly society through legal action. It's not going to happen. Our goal is to use the available structures of the legal system in order to try to minimize the amount of harm which some of these very large companies are doing to very vulnerable individuals. And I do think, you know, there's a constant theme in Christian understanding of ethics, and we've talked about this many times, are the widows and the orphans and the aliens. It's, you know, God says these are the people I am particularly concerned about. It's the vulnerable, it's those who have no voice, it's those who can't defend themselves. And surely when we come to social media, you know, it is by and large vulnerable individuals who are most at risk and who are being targeted by TikTok and by these other companies. And therefore, standing up for them and supporting their rights and their protection seems to me entirely appropriate for a Christian.
But isn't the lawsuit the wrong method? I agree with you that you can easily defend this principle on Christian grounds, but surely the answer is to say, well, I won't let my children have a smartphone and be on social media to protect them, and I will campaign for all children to be, all schools to be phone free, or for governments to introduce bans like they have in Australia. I'm not going to get into complex, murky legal and financial discussions and try and negotiate with the forces of evil themselves, the executives at TikTok and Meta and Google. I'm going to stand prophetically outside the camp, calling them to the light. And what they should do is shutter their programs or institute strict age checks. We don't need to get messing around with lawsuits and try and get some kind of shakedown. These companies get some kind of payoff out of them. That's not the Christian way.
Well, I think that we recognize there are different ways of acting as salt and light in broken and fallen societies. And it's certainly true there is a place for that kind of prophetic voice that comes outside society, which says, woe unto you. You know, you social media companies, you will...
Whitewash, you know, tombs, the words come to mind.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair comment. But I think that many Christians over the ages, and quite rightly, have also perceived that acting within society as salt, as a preservative, to try to overcome and minimize harm is also a godly action and something that Jesus said he called us to. And therefore, I think that using the structures of society in order to try to minimize the damage, it seems to me very Pharisaical, actually, to simply say, well, I kept my hands clean, you know, I watched while terrible things, people were being abused and damaged. But it was, you know, it was nothing to do with me. I just kept my hands clean. I told them it was wrong. I said, stop. You know, I think that certainly as a medic, I think we and for other people working within society, you think of social workers and lawyers and so on. We understand that it's often a murky business working in a fallen world, but we're trying to use wisdom and discretion and judgment to try to minimize the amount of harm being done. And that in itself is good.
Yeah. And you see this harm minimization idea is, I think, it's kind of cornerstone of certainly the UK's kind of longstanding policy on tobacco and smoking, which has, you know, we know it's incredibly harmful and destructive. But we also know that if we try to just kind of use law as a blunt instrument and make it illegal overnight to smoke, there would be, you haven't taken the demand away. People are addicted, and there would be an explosion in illegal cigarettes, which largely funds, you know, terrorism and organized crime and whatever else. And so instead, they've approached a harm minimization approach, which says over many years, we will kind of bear down on the the builders of supply. So we will crack down on advertising and on packaging, and we will make it harder for young people to buy them. And we will force massively increased taxation to both make it more expensive to pursue the habit, but also to generate revenue to cover some of the harms. And that has been highly successful. And smoking rates have, you know, more than halved since their heyday in the middle of the 20th century. And they continue to fall quite dramatically.
Yeah. And you know, I think your thing about seatbelts is a really interesting point. I mean, if it hadn't been for that, we might still be, you know, it's just voluntarily, you know, do you want a car with seatbelts or not, sir? You know, I mean, it's entirely up to you. You know, do we think that actually it's better that because of those legal cases, because manufacturers were held to account by lawyers in a sort of fallen world, nonetheless, that meant that our cars were hugely more safe because of those legal actions? And absolutely the same is true for planes. You know, why are planes so incredibly safe? It's because the plane manufacturers know that there are going to be legal cases if any of their planes fall out of the sky. So I think there are mechanisms here. And ultimately, it does come to a concept of justice, doesn't it? And a God who is a God of justice, a God who holds us to account, and therefore creating structures, human structures, which at least, however imperfectly, reflect the God of justice, is appropriate. And we should be prepared to use those structures when it seems the best way of minimizing harm.
And I think part of the challenge for some Christians is that harm minimization can seem to kind of adopt a very pragmatic approach to questions of morality. It's entirely focused on outcomes and consequences. It's not focused on virtues and character and absolute laws. And you see that in the argument about drugs, for example. You know, a lot of the medical experts will say, look, if we adopt a harm minimization approach to illegal drugs, we would actually save thousands of lives every year. We could cut off funding to the organized crime groups that produce this and cause so much misery. But it would involve us looking the other way. And rather than imprisoning people automatically for using drugs, even small amounts, but us offering them, you know, counseling and support and psychotherapy and clean needles and safe places, and we can test the quality of their drugs. And a lot of Christians say, well, hold on, drugs are wrong, end of story, black and white. A crime is a crime. I can't look the other way. God doesn't want us to look the other way. God wants us to uphold an objective standard of morality and therefore struggle with the kind of loosey-goosey, we're totally focused on consequences and harms only approach of harm minimization.
Yeah, and I get that. And this is a long-standing debate and discussion, and it's often within the Christian medical world because doctors differ, for instance, on supplying contraceptives to a young teenager who is promiscuous. Is that an appropriate thing to do? Are you somehow encouraging sexual activity inappropriate?
At the very least, condoning extramarital sex, something that we know is a sin.
And should I just give a lecture and say, well, what you're doing is wrong and I can have nothing to do with you, and I will support you and encourage you, but I can't give you contraception? I think a lot of Christian doctors have concluded that, yes, we would take the opportunity, although within the limits of what we're allowed to do within the UK NHS, to explain why we think that promiscuous sexual activity is a bad idea, including what its medical risks are. But that if you are absolutely committed to this lifestyle, we think it's better at least to avoid pregnancy. And interestingly, the statistics show that the number of abortions between the 15 to 18 year old group has actually gone down, whereas the abortions of all other age groups have gone up about in over 18s. Abortions have gone down in under 18s. So this is at least part due to the fact of wider use of long-acting contraceptives in this age group. Although it has to be said, TikTok is also part of the explanation, because if you're in your bedroom watching TikTok, it's quite hard to get pregnant.
Yes. And you see this, there's a big debate in the Catholic Church, which obviously has a kind of a priori objection to contraception. And that frustrates a lot of Catholics and others kind of working in the developing world, when particularly when the AIDS crisis is at its peak. saying, you know, please, please, please allow priests, allow Catholic medical institutions to encourage condom use, and we could save people from catching this horrible, horrible disease. And the church said, the rules are the rules. The law is the law. God's rules do not bend and flex around harm minimization. They are absolute and objective. Well, we've kind of been all over the place in this episode, haven't we? Gone in some unexpected directions. So let's bring it into land, drawing those threads together. I think what to say. I mean, the social media addiction trials are going to be significant, I think, and not just necessarily in the outcome, but which is hard to predict, but also but in what is exposed during the trial, what we learn about how these algorithms work, and hopefully what evidence is introduced to show what these algorithms and these addictive apps are doing to us, particularly young people and their very kind of plastic brains. So I think that is something to keep an eye on for sure.
And I think that these legal cases are at least a shot across the bows of large companies that seem to behave as if they are beyond account, that they can basically do what they like. There are enormous power enshrined. We haven't mentioned the fact that OpenAI have recently announced that they're going to start putting adverts in their ChatGPT in the free and low paid version. So again, you know, if you're prepared to pay a significant amount of money each month, you can have an ad free version. But I think this, unfortunately, is likely to become widespread with AI chatbots as well. The advertising model is here to stay, but I think there is a strong case for using legal sanctions, and as a Christian, I feel that can be supported when the goal is particularly to try to protect the most vulnerable individuals.
Yeah, I think I broadly agree. I think there are interesting, complex ethical debates here about, you know, what is our calling and how do we be salt and light. But I think I go back to the example of Jesus, and I don't see someone who was preoccupied with ensuring that his hands were unsullied by kind of pollution from the world's sin and muck and complexity, but quite the opposite, someone who was determined to kind of go to dark places to pursue the lost and to speak up for the last and those whom, you know, the widow, the orphan, the stranger, even at some social cost from his kind of religious peers. And I think that has to be our model as well, not trying to retreat into some holy huddle, or simply, though there is a role for this, kind of standing at the gates of the city and calling down condemnation prophetically. But actually, if that involves using some of the flawed instruments available to us, including the legal system, to try and bring about justice for people that God cares about, I think that is right.
And there are many Christians working in the legal profession, both in the UK and the USA. And I think that these kind of activities, and not just those, there are many cases where I think Christians see their activities upholding justice in its different forms as something that resonates very strongly with their Christian convictions. And it's often been said, sort of the phrase of seeking the good of the city. Yes, we're alien residents, but nonetheless, we have a responsibility to seek the good of the society in which God has placed us.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, well, let's draw it to a close there. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'd love to know your own thoughts about this, about social media addiction or using the legal system and tort law to try and extort some justice out of these hard to unaccountable tech companies and everything else we've discussed today. Do get in touch with us. You can email MOLAD, MOLAD at premier.org.uk. We'd also be really keen to hear suggestions about things we could talk about on future episodes. Thank you for those who've been sending in questions and links and comments. We'd love to read. We read everyone. You can find lots of interesting resources on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com, W-Y-A-T-T. And if you can read some of my own journalism on my website, that's tswyatt.com. And in particular, please do sign up for free to my Critical Friend weekly newsletter about church news. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Hi, it's Gavin.
I'm Phil.
I don't know about you, but it can sometimes feel like we're living in a bad news world. Wars, scandals, crisis after crisis.
But if you're ready to change the soundtrack and hear what God is really doing, we have a brand new podcast just for you.
We're traveling the UK, seeing people come to faith, churches grow, and new life break out.
With real stories, fresh research, and inspiring leaders, we are ready to give you a front row seat to God on the move.
Good News People is a new podcast from Premier and the Evangelical Alliance.
So listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are Good News People in a bad news world.